various types, people who we generally call the progressives, took on the many evils of American society. And they won, well, at least, sort of. And that's an important statement. Important because that's what I'm going to talk about for today's lecture, and at least part of tomorrow's lecture, and also because it is study question number one for your second midterm exam. Notice right at the top of the outline that I passed out to you, generalization. In the early years of the 20th century, crusaders of various types took on all the many evils plaguing American society, crime, disease, corruption, poverty, ignorance, and injustice, and won, at least, sort of. Okay, what do I want you to do? I want you to talk about the evils of American society in the early years of the 20th century, but particularly the way various crusaders took on those evils. I will be focusing on three progressive presidents in particular, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and Woodrow Wilson. I'll also be mentioning some other progressives like Robert M. Lafayette. What I want you to be able to do is talk about the ways in which these men took on some of the evils of American society in and the ways in which they win. But notice that the last words are sort of. Progressive victory certainly not complete, and you'll see as we go through this this material that certainly this was not a full victory of the forces of good over the forces of evil, no, not by a long shot. Now, to take on all the evils of the early years of the 20th century was something like David taking on Goliath, or even better, Hercules taking on the Hydra. Some of you remember from high school mythology classes the story of the Hydra, many-headed monster that various Greek heroes, it depends on your version of the legend, but various Greek heroes have to confront this Hydra. In one version of the legend, it is Hercules, the great hero, who takes on the Hydra. The Hydra has many heads, but the problem is you cut off a head of the Hydra, and that head grows back. The secret is to figure out what, which is the immortal head. You deal with the immortal head, you bury it under a rock or something, and then once you take care of the immortal head, then the other heads are not going to grow back. And so really that's a good analogy for taking on the evils of American society. It is a many-headed monster that you're facing in the early years of the 20th century. You try to deal with one head of the Hydra, and it's just going to come back. You try to deal with another head, and it's going to come back. Figure out which is the immortal head, which is the head you really have to deal with that's giving life to all the other sources of evil in American society. Well, what are some of the heads of our many-headed monster threatening to devour Americans and American freedom and prosperity? One head, of course, is the exploitation of the workers that we talked about a lot before the midterm. Workers in the factories working for low wages under unsafe working conditions, producing a tremendous amount of wealth, but very, very little of that wealth going to them, instead going to people that are just basically exploiting their labor. Exploitation of factory workers is certainly one of the evils confronting American society, an evil that any kind of reformer is going to want to take on. Another head of the Hydra, the exploitation of the farmers, or the destruction, really, of many of the independent farmers. The independent farmer had been the backbone of America, and like Thomas Jefferson, had believed that that was really the cornerstone of American democracy. The independent farmer working for himself, in Jefferson's words, if ever God had a chosen people, it's them, the farm types, while paraphrasing Jefferson. But the independent farmers were in real trouble as well. Income on the farms, in some instances, was even worse than the income for factory laborers. Farmers were losing their land right and left, subject to very, very high interest rates from banks, interest rates perhaps as high as 40%, the profits disappearing. Where? Well, International Harvester was making a lot of money, John Deere was making a lot of money, banks making a lot of money, the railroads making a lot of money, but what about the farmers themselves, the people that are producing the incredible products of America's, all commodities, wheat and corn and hogs and soybeans and everything else, these people that are producing that wealth are not getting their fair share of that. Certainly something else that needs to be taken care of. And another head of the Hydra, the problems in the urban areas. As the urban areas grow very, very quickly, becoming very crowded, you have the tenement style housing, you have rises in crime, rise in prostitution, poor sanitation, and all of those kinds of things. Now, all right, those are some of the heads of the Hydra, but nobody would say that that's the immoral head. What is the immoral head? Where are these problems coming from? Now, first suggestion that many people would have, I suppose, is that all of these evils are stemming from big business, from the Rockefellers, from the Morgans, from the Carnegies. These people, after all, are the ones who are making their tremendous fortunes on the backs of American workers. And certainly, also, it looked like these big businessmen are the ones who are responsible, to a certain extent at least, for exploiting some of the evils of this country overseas. You get Minor Keith starting United Fruit in Costa Rica, Samuel Guggenheim taking advantage of copper resources in Mexico. It looked like America, not America, but American businessmen are extending their reach to the rest of the world as well, and having a negative influence on other societies as well. Perhaps that is the immortal head, but perhaps the immortal head is something else. Maybe the immortal head, the source of all the other problems, just maybe it is political corruption in America. And from what I understand, how many of you were just in Dr. Schaff's class? From what I understand, he was talking to you about the progressives, that they felt that they needed to make political changes before they could make policy changes. Is that what he just told you, basically? Mm-hmm. Okay. And from one point of view, it might have been political corruption that had to be dealt with, some changes in the political system, before any of the other problems could be dealt with. And certainly this point of view makes a certain amount of sense. You see, for instance, at the local level, the city is controlled by men like Boss Tweed. Now, Tweed himself goes to prison, but it took a mighty long time, and even when Tweed is gone, it certainly did not end the corruption of New York City government. And all of the cities in America have faced similar kinds of problems. So at the local level, it was very, very hard to address some of the problems that America faced because of the corruption of the political system. And at the national level, too, it looked like the corruption had gotten all the way to the top, when big business could raise all sorts of money, because they don't want, you got Grover Cleveland, who wants the tariff to go, we got too much money in the Treasury, let's give it back to the taxpayers, let's cut that tariff rate. Big business wants that tariff, and so they raise money. Now, nothing wrong with raising money, but when you're paying people 20 bucks a vote and encouraging to vote early and vote often, that's not so good. And when big business can raise even more money, $16 million to campaign against William Jennings Bryan, certainly it looked like not only could corrupt businessmen, not only could they buy off local governments, but they could even buy the presidency of the United States. Well, at first, in 1900, if that wasn't enough to discourage those people that would be champions of justice, consider the failure of earlier attempts at the reform. Just about every reform movement we looked at somehow got twisted, didn't quite accomplish what it was supposed to. Notice the Sherman Act, Sherman Free Silver Act, but the Sherman Antitrust Act. The Sherman Antitrust Act, what had happened? Had it reigned in the Rockefellers of the world? Had it reigned in the Morgans of the world? No. The Sherman Antitrust Act got turned away from its original purpose against labor, to crush labor unions, to make strikes seem to be violations of conspiracies in restraint of free trade. And then you had organizations like the Knights of Labor, who for a time seemed like they were going to be successful, grew very rapidly, and then because of the failure of a strike and because the newspapers blamed them for some of the violence of the Haymarket riot, all of a sudden the Knights of Labor, after just a couple years of success, the Knights of Labor fades into insignificance. The Grange likewise had some initial success, and you would have thought, oh wow, here's our party to make things right for the, or not our party, but our organization that's going to get things right for the farmers. But no, the Grange too, as they had tried to compete with John Deere, as they tried to compete with International Harvester, the Grange found that they couldn't compete, their business dealings collapsed, and they go back to being a social organization, and then the biggest reform movement of all up to that point, the Populist Party. The Populist Party seemed to have everything going for it. Not only did the Populists have a candidate in William Jennings Bryan, who was one of probably the best political order in America. Not only that, their candidate had the endorsement of a major party, the endorsement of the Democratic Party. In fact, the Democrats had nominated Bryan first. They had everything going for them. They had great issues, they had a great candidate, a great campaign, and yet they were defeated by Mark Hanna and the $16 million that he raised. At first, it looked like the 20th century was going to be more of the same, that the voices for reform were going to simply be silenced, that they would never be able to overcome the vested interests, the big business interests, the corrupt politicians, and all of that. Certainly, the 1900 election, in some ways, must have seemed very discouraging to those people who still thought America needed major reform. 1900. What happens in the 1900 election? Well, Sand candidates at the top of the ticket, as in 1896. William McKinley, after 4 years as president, going to run for a second term as the Republican candidate, and certainly a candidate that had the backing of big business, particularly Mark Hanna, Ohio businessman, one of the wealthiest men in America. McKinley was his man. I don't know if I mentioned this line, but it's a line that I love from Rachel Lindsay's Bryan, Bryan, Bryan. In that poem in honor of Bryan, at one point, Lindsay asked the question, "Where is McKinley? Mark Hanna's McKinley, his slave, his echo, his suit of clothes." And I think that's just one of the greatest insult lines in all of history, that all McKinley is Mark Hanna's slave, his echo, his suit of clothes. In other words, he can put on and take off politicians as he wants. He can change them whatever he feels like. Just like you change your clothes, Mark Hanna can change his politicians. And the question, where is McKinley? McKinley stayed home. McKinley, by the way, in that campaign against Bryan, He didn't go out and give speeches and try to influence people. No, he just let Mark Hanna run the campaign and send out, hire speakers and buy literature and all of that. So where was McKinley? Who knows? Well, the 1900 campaign going to be more of the same. McKinley at the top of the ticket. The Democrats nominate William Jennings Bryan again. Well, how is Bryan going to have a chance? He couldn't beat McKinley before. How can he now beat an incumbent president? Well, it seemed like William Jennings Bryan this time had an issue that might catch on with the American people, a new issue. Certainly, Bryan had the old issues that he had dealt with before, the need for reform, and pushing for free silver and all that. But the new issue was American imperialism. In 1898, we had fought that Spanish-American war. And going into the war, those people that supported it, including President McKinley, said that for us to annex any territory would be criminal aggression. The only reason, they said, we were going into that Spanish-American war was to defend these Spanish colonies, the people in those colonies, against ruthless exploitation by the Spanish, defending them against Weller the Butcher and all of that. Oh, those Spaniards, they are so cruel. We are going to stand up. We are going to be, as we always have, the champions of freedom, the champions of human rights. But after the Spanish-American War was over, what happened? What was I told you before the midterm? This was a puzzle. What could you do? Could you simply go alone? Well, no, everything would fly off into disorder. You couldn't just make the Spanish Spanish go alone and leave a total mess, leave total confusion. And especially you couldn't do that because there were European nations that were very aggressive, Germany in particular, looking for every square inch of territory that he could claim. And if the Americans simply go home after the Spanish-American War, well, in come the Germans. And the Germans are certainly not going to be any better than the Spanish, and so we would have fought that whole splendid little war for nothing. But what do we do? Well, I mentioned to you what we did in Cuba and Puerto Rico and Guam, or maybe I didn't, but whatever. We stayed there and made some improvements in sanitation and eventually gave them quasi-independence and all of that, or in the case of Puerto Rico, make them an American territory. But what about the Philippines? I mentioned to you briefly before the midterm what happened in the Philippines. That initially, We just sailed into Manila Harbor, almost no casualties on the American side, 7 wounded sailors, took the Philippines away from Spain almost before the Spanish even knew that there was a war going on. And one of the reasons it was so easy is that the Filipinos had joined us. The Filipinos did not want Spanish rule, and so the Americans appeared to be liberators. Then the Americans did not go. And the Filipinos, many of the Filipinos, began to resent this. And so the Filipinos began to stage an insurrection, trying to drive the Americans out. It was obvious immediately that the Filipinos were no match for America in direct combat. Now, if you are a Filipino, you want independence. You want these Americans to go home, but you cannot fight them directly. What's the alternative? If you cannot win a direct war, what do?
Guerrilla warfare.
You resort to guerrilla warfare, and that is what happens in the Philippines. And the Americans were unprepared to fight a guerrilla warfare. How do you deal with the people that attack here and attack there? They don't, they don't do what they're supposed to do. They don't line up in nice, neat lines with their officers on one side and your officers on one side giving commands. How do you defeat the people that resorts to guerrilla warfare? It is not so easy. But unfortunately, in reacting to guerrilla warfare, many of the commanders, many of the officers, sometimes with orders from Washington, did not behave in the standards that most Americans would expect. One military captain said, "We should not attempt to meet a half-civilized foe with the same methods devised for civilized warfare against people of our own race, country, and blood." In other words, the rules are different. We're fighting against half-savages. We don't have to follow the usual usages of warfare. Now, what does that mean? That means when American troops are killed by Filipino guerrillas, and of course the guerrillas disappear, what do you do? Matt, what do you do?
I don't know.
You shake your head. You don't know what to do. Anybody ruthless enough?
Burn the villages.
You just strike out, and American troops massacred prisoners. They massacred civilians, not paying any attention, killing, wiping out entire villages, including women and children. One famous incident: an American major captured a Filipino village, and his order: kill everyone over 10. Now, under his command, there were some who said, "No, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do that. We are not going to obey that that command." Nevertheless, that is the kind of thing that's going on in the Philippines: is that commanders are ordering entire villages to be wiped out, bodies of Filipinos routinely mutilated, horrible kinds of ways, as a warning to these Filipinos. Now you're getting these atrocity stories all of the time. These stories are coming back to the United States. And there were many, many people in America who said, "We cannot do this. This is not in accord with our principles." Great writers like Mark Twain, and I mentioned this to you briefly before, but I'll say this again. Mark Twain had what he called a pen warmed up in hell. And Mark Twain, by this time, his pen warmed up in hell. It was red hot. Mark Twain, it's wonderful writing in a way. His images and his criticism of America and its principles, I mean, it's just that kind of clever writing that you can only do when you're incredibly angry. And when you've got men like Mark Twain writing about American atrocities and how hypocritical it is and how much we're violating our own principles, you would think, here is an issue. William Jennings Bryan can take up the imperialist issue. Now, the Spanish-American War ends 1898, okay? We're still fighting in the still fighting in the Philippines, though, fighting an insurrection, and what William Jennings Bryan should be able to do is say, we should not be here. Let's bring American troops home. Let's let the Filipinos have their independence. And by the way, just to give you an idea of the magnitude of what's going on here, in the Philippines, ultimately, there are more than 4,000 American deaths, 20,000 Filipino soldiers killed, and more than 200,000 civilian casualties, okay? Now, we don't have that total yet. This is in the middle of the Philippine insurrection. The insurrection will go on until 1902. 1900 is campaign year. You're getting these stories of American atrocities constantly throughout this time. Okay, at first, Bryan runs with this issue. He runs with the anti-imperialism issue, but he finds very quickly that he is making no headway at all. People are not rushing to support William Jennings Bryan because they think that the United States needs to come home from the Philippines. Question, why do you think this is? Why is it that Bryan could not make any headway at all? And he realized it. He saw that he was not making any headway at all, not stirring up any enthusiasm by running an anti-imperialist campaign. Newspapers are lining up on both sides. There are certainly newspapers that, if you read them today, you would be appalled. One newspaper editorialized that we want the Philippines. We don't want the Filipinos, and they were prepared out-and-out genocide. I mean, really, they said, you know, it's going to take us a while. There are a million or two million or whatever it is that are there. But there were some newspapers in this country who were prepared to say, we want the Philippines. We don't care about the Filipinos. They're just a bunch of Malays or whatever they are. And so you have the newspapers that are perfectly all right with those kinds of atrocities. So, yeah, newspapers are going to be a factor here. Some of them, though.
What about Hearst?
Oh, Hearst is going to be pro-war. I mean, he wanted this war in the first place. It's his war.
Just wasn't close to the American public.
Okay, and now we're getting out of the order that I wanted here, but that's true. It is very, very hard to interest the American people in foreign affairs. Rarely, not never, but rarely are foreign issues going to be the turning point of a campaign. I was thinking about this morning. What about the last election between President Obama and John McCain? How important was foreign policy to that election? I mean, if you ask people, what did you not like about George W. Bush? Those that didn't like it. What would they have said? First of all,
warmonger. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's what you would have thought, that it's Iraq and Afghanistan, and that's the thing that made Bush, Bush at one time, you know, had 80% approval ratings right after 9/11. 80% approval rating, and you would have thought that, you know, like all of this, but what's that? You know, and I'm not going to give you a definite answer here, because it's just I'm wondering about this. How much do we care? Because what changed as far as our foreign policy when President Obama took over? How is this policy different? Is foreign policy different from George W.'s?
It's not.
Are we out of Iraq? I mean, we were winding down while Bush was still president, but we're still there. So getting there, casualty. I got one guy from church, one young man from our church is being activated, and he's being sent off to Iraq, and maybe some of you have friends that are headed off there. Afghanistan? We out of Afghanistan?
No.
And are we less involved? Is our commitment, is our military commitment lesser greater?
Are we still in Somalia?
Well, we're in Libya.
It's greater now, but he did campaign that he was going to pull everyone out and close Cuba and all that.
Yeah.
He didn't live up to any of that.
Right.
Yeah, but he didn't have the backing of Congress either, so it doesn't matter what he wanted.
Well, I mean, all I'm doing is I'm thinking about this issue of, you know, I'm going to talk about Brian, why Brian can't use this imperialism issue. And what about today? Is foreign policy, is that really where it is? Or would Bush's foreign policy have made no difference at all if the American economy hadn't gone through a downturn?
If America's economy was going great, then somebody would care one way or the other because they would not be in their satisfaction.
That's kind of what I'm thinking. And again, I don't want to say that as this is the way things are, but it does puzzle me to a certain extent that foreign issues don't really seem, and even when they would seem, oh yeah, this is at the forefront, maybe not. Okay, so Cindy hits what I think maybe the main reason that Ryan would make this work is people didn't care. I mean, people really didn't care. Didn't care about something that happens thousands and thousands of miles away. It's not really real. That's part of it. Any other reason that you can't catch on with this imperialism campaign? And I think that Cindy's reason is perhaps the most important. There's another reason, too.
Well, I think that
what's the problem with campaigning against a war while the war is going on?
Anti-patriotic.
Yeah. If you're against a war, you're anti-America, anti-the flag, it is very, very easy to be seen as unpatriotic if you don't support America. But beyond that, what else is a problem? What are you doing? If you're at home, and America is fighting a war abroad, and you're complaining about that war, what are you doing?
Complaining.
Well, complaining and doing what?
Nothing about it.
Well, which part of it is it? Who are you encouraging? See, you're encouraging the enemy.
Technically.
It's more than technical, because you see, what happens in warfare is, you know, you just continue the conflict on both sides. People die on both sides until somebody decides to give up. And if the other side of warfare, if the other side of a war decides to fight longer, you know, now, it's a tricky business. If you're not going to finish your conflict, if you're not going to finish your war, maybe campaigning against a war ultimately is going to save the lives of American soldiers. But what temporarily it does is it encourages your enemy to fight on. What chance do the Filipinos have against the American army? Not very much. But their hope is that the minds of the American people will change. And that was a specific, the Filipino president, the man who at least the Filipino insurgents wanted to have as the president, said, "In America, there is a great party that insists on the government recognizing Filipino independence. We should pray to God that the great Democratic Party may win the next presidential election." Suppose Osama bin Laden had said, "There is a great party in the United States that will take American troops home from Afghanistan. We should pray that the great Democratic Party win the next presidential election." How's that going to play in America? Very well. And you see, it's tough. All right. Man. I'm sorry. I got off on a sidetrack. It's not a sidetrack, but that took longer than it should have. Brian realizes that he's not making any headway, and so what does he do? He goes back to what he knows people are concerned about. That is domestic issues. But here too, Brian can't make any headway because McKinley's campaign comes up with some absolutely brilliant slogans to run against Brian, slogans that convinced the American people that McKinley was the man to support. What were these slogans in 1900, the winning slogans of the 1900 campaign? The first slogan, 4 more years of the full dinner pay. In other words, you know, you've done pretty well under McKinley. You got plenty to eat it. You know, when you have your dinner, you got enough to eat. Let's have 4 more years of that. And then I think the greatest campaign slogan of all of American history, leave well enough alone. Leave well enough alone. Okay. Leave well enough alone. Now, I will bet that I have some students in this class who would vote for a candidate whose slogan was, leave well enough alone. Quit messing with things. Yes? Eric, you have some libertarian leanings. Leave well enough alone.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it to be worse.
I know my son RJ, he's just so libertarian. Many of his friends, they just are so, they don't want either party. They don't want the Republicans, they don't want the Democrats. Just leave us alone. Quit trying to fix things. Leave us alone. How many of you have friends like that?
Yeah.
Leave us alone. I am not sure. Let well enough alone. I'm not sure, but I vote for a candidate whose campaign promise was leave well enough alone. I don't know. I might be too.
The problem is they don't.
They don't, that's right. They don't leave well enough alone.
No, I mean, when Bush and Gore were there, you would have thought with the surplus and everything, there would, you know, whoever you voted in, if you just left it alone, everything would have been clicking. It just didn't happen that way.
No. Don't just do something, stand there. That would be the message for our politicians. I don't know. Anyway.
Stop.
Americans, in 1900, we elect McKinley. O'Brien makes a pretty good showing, but it is pretty much a solid mandate for McKinley. 4 more years of full dinner pay. And so America in 1900 had voted for what? 4 more years of the status quo. But actually, that's what Americans thought they had voted for. What they ended up with is a man who would make some major changes in the American system. McKinley? No, not really McKinley. Marquez. McKinley, his slave, his echo, his suit of clothes. But in electing McKinley, they had also elected his running mate, Theodore Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt, the first of our progressive presidents, we'll talk to you about that in a second. A little bit of background. 5'8 cap undergraduate from Harvard, squinty-eyed, glasses-wearing scholar, author of over 30 volumes and an expert on, well, if you ask Roosevelt himself, he was an expert on just about everything. But there were other sides of it.
He had a very sickly childhood.
That's right. Yes, strenuous, and he writes about it in Strenuous Life, how he builds it by boxing and other kinds of things, how he turns himself into a rugged man. as part of his willingness to take on challenges, Roosevelt went to North Dakota, spent some winters as a ranch owner and cowboy in the North Dakota Badlands, taking on some of the worst winters on record in that particular area. He was also a military man. He uh, he had become Assistant Secretary of the Navy, but when the Spanish-American War broke out, he didn't sit behind his desk. He resigned his commission and went to Cuba. You all heard of his famous charge up San Juan Hill. Teddy Roosevelt and his Rough Riders, who were not riders by this time, they were not a mounted unit, but he delighted in fighting in this this war, and he wrote about his delight in seeing his shoe Spaniard, seeing that dead Spaniard curl up like a jackrabbit. You know, this is just like going hunting prairie dogs with that, hunt Spaniards or something like that. In any case, Teddy Roosevelt was not afraid of a fight, and he could be a real thorn in the side to anyone who he decided that he was going to fight against. When he returned from the Spanish-American War, he was elected the governor of New York, and he was a thorn in the side to the political bosses in New York. What do you do with this guy? Well, you kick him upstairs. You don't assassinate him and send him to heaven. You figure out a way to get him not to be governor of New York anymore. And so what do? Well, it's interesting that what happens, and this has happened several times actually in American politics, is that corrupt political bosses will elevate a man either that they think that they can use and it turns out that they can't use him, or they'll elevate him to get him out of their way and will backfire on them. But the political bosses of New York decided that what they had to do to get Teddy out of New York was to get him to go to D.C. How do you get him to go to D.C.? Well, they engineered a movement. They wanted to make him the vice presidential candidate for McKinley. Now, why do you want to make a guy like Roosevelt, why do you want to make him vice president? Well, John Adams had said that my nation has devised for me the most insignificant office ever devised by the mind of man, and I don't have to quote exactly right. But the vice presidency of the United States, essentially, what does the vice president do? The vice president just waits around for the president. Oh, yeah, the vice president is supposed to preside over the Senate, but most of the time they don't do that. The vice president has just about no responsibilities. So the idea is you kick Teddy upstairs, you make him vice president, but how do you get Teddy to accept this position? Teddy knows that the vice presidency is a kind of a do-nothing position, and he is not a do-nothing man. But Roosevelt has a tremendous ego, and the political bosses knew that if you could appeal to Roosevelt's ego, you would get him to do things he might not otherwise do. And so at the convention, they organized a movement to chant, "We want Teddy! We want Teddy! We want Teddy!" And Roosevelt was not the kind of a man, when there are hundreds and hundreds of people chanting his name, "Ah, you want me? Okay, I am ready to serve." And so Roosevelt resigns as governor to become vice president of the United States. Now, Mark Hanna was no fool. He realized that the Republican Party was playing with fire. He said, "Don't any of you realize that there's only one life between that madman and the White House?" Well, apparently they didn't, but they should have. This was a time internationally for the assassinations, and an anarchist whose name I can't pronounce begins with a C, Skolsk or something like that. Anyway, an anarchist assassinated McKinley 6 months into McKinley's second term, and Teddy Roosevelt was president. Congress still dominated, however, by conservative-type Republicans, and so even though Roosevelt is president, it's not at all clear that he's going to be able to accomplish much. So, what is Roosevelt going to do? Well, you've all heard Roosevelt's famous phrase, "Speak softly, carry a big stick." I'm not sure how often Teddy spoke softly, but he certainly was willing to carry a big stick. Whenever he was confronted with what he considered to be injustice, he would take whatever steps he was able to take to confront that injustice. Teddy Roosevelt promised the American people that what they would start getting from now on was what he called a square deal. Now, we're going to talk about a lot of different deals in American history. We're going to talk about a square deal under Teddy Roosevelt. We'll talk about a new deal under Franklin Roosevelt. Later, we'll talk about a fair deal under Harry Truman. Lots and lots of different deals, and it's important to know what these deals are with each of these presidents. What is Teddy Roosevelt's square deal? Please don't get caught and confused with the fair deal, the new deal that we'll talk about later, or the fair deal that we'll talk about still later. Roosevelt's square deal says, he says, when I say I believe in a square deal, I do not mean to give every man the best hand. If the cards do not come to any man, or if they do come and he has not got the power to play them, that is his affair. All I mean is that there shall be no crookedness in the dealing. That's the basic message of the square deal. Teddy Roosevelt is going to make sure that the cards are dealt fairly. All right, a nice sentiment. But with Roosevelt, it was going to be more than a sentiment. What could he do to try to create for Americans a square deal, fair treatment, eliminate some of the crookedness in the deal? Well, Pennsylvania coal miner strike, 1902. Mine conditions were absolutely terrible. There were many accidents, workers getting hurt and killed on the job. The workers went on strike, demanding that their workday be reduced from 10 hours to 9 hours. And you can see why you want this. When you're overly tired, that's when the accidents happen. You reduce your workday to 9 hours, and it's going to save lives. They also wanted a 20% pay increase. Well, the mine owners would not negotiate. They just let the strike drag on and on and on. And with coal a major fuel source for Pennsylvania, what that meant is that all of a sudden there were all sorts of side effects of this strike. There wasn't enough coal, so schools had to close down, hospitals had to close down, factories started shutting down as well. Roosevelt was incensed at what he called the stupidity and bad temper of the mine owners, and so he seized his big stick. He threatened to send in federal troops to forcibly open the mines, let the miners go back to work, but no longer controlled by the mine owners. The federal government was going to intervene. Why? So the hospitals could operate, the schools could operate, the factories once again. Well, this threat was enough to bring the mine owners to the bargaining table. They still acted in bad faith. They didn't want any union representatives to negotiate with. Roosevelt appointed to the commission one man who was a former, he was a former union vice president. But Roosevelt says, oh, no, he's an eminent sociologist. And so eventually there was a negotiation of that strike. Now, this was a big, big shift in the nature of the government and labor. Prior to this time, government intervention had been on behalf of the big business owners. Remember Cleveland intervening to protect the U.S. Mails in the case of the Pullman strike and riots. Now Roosevelt is using federal troops on behalf of the striking miners, and that's a big, big change. Roosevelt also had another big stick that he could use. This is in some ways more important. A big stick that he could use when big corporations did not behave in the way that he thought they should. His other big stick was the Sherman Antitrust Act, but he would use it to threaten to break up trusts. What had happened here is that Rockefeller and Morgan had both wanted to control the Burlington Railroad. They bid up the stock of the Burlington Railroad sky high, a lot more than the thing was worth, and then there was a crash, and that had negative repercussions, people losing their savings and all of that. And then Rockefeller and Morgan got together to form the Northern Securities Company, and they decided, well, we will run it jointly. We won't compete with it. You know, typical of these big businesses, they compete, they cause all sorts of damage to people, and then they get together, well, we won't compete with it anymore. Roosevelt uses the Sherman Act to break up the Northern Securities Company, and having used his big stick effectively there, he now can bring suit against other trusts as well. Roosevelt launches 40 suits against various trusts, the tobacco trust, the beet trust, and all that. He's cutting off heads right and left, well, except he's not really cutting them off. What Roosevelt is doing is he's threatening these companies. If you are a trust and you don't behave yourself, we're going to break you up all together. The trusts don't, and I have to emphasize this is only a sort of victory. Roosevelt, occasionally these suits will be successful, occasionally the trust will break up, but for the most part, Roosevelt is content if the trusts behave themselves. If they don't do idiot things like Rockefeller and Morgan had done with forming the Northern Securities Company and being upset and then crash. That's a partial victory then for the forces of reform. Roosevelt also manages to persuade Congress to pass what's called the Elkins Act. This regulates rails. It forbids the rebate type of thing, the thing that Rockefeller had used to undercut his competition. It also, interestingly enough, forbid the rails from giving free passes. The rails were in the habit of letting government officials just ride for free anywhere they wanted, in return for the government, of course, kind of turning a blind eye to anything that the railroads were doing. The Elkins Act forbid that kind of favoritism in transportation. Roosevelt also began a program to set aside land, public land, so that it wouldn't just simply be destroyed. 125 million acres of timber reserves set aside, coal reserves, places for there would be plenty of fresh water as well. Roosevelt's plan was for much of this public land to be open to activities like recreation, to sustainable yield logging. You could log that area, but not, you know, you couldn't just strip it. You know, conservation type.
Wasn't he responsible for establishing the first National Park Yosemite?
Yeah, this is the direction we're going with this. Roosevelt setting aside national lands for those kinds of purposes. Roosevelt, not surprisingly, was a very popular president. In the election of 1904, wasn't even close. The Democrats put up a conservative candidate, Judge Alvin Parker. The popular vote, 7,623,000 for Teddy Roosevelt, 5,077,000 for Judge Alvin Parker. It's probably, certainly the biggest margin in a presidential election for a long, long time. Most of the elections of the 19th century had been within a few percentages. Cleveland actually had won the popular vote and lost an election. Very, very unusual for a candidate to get much more than 50% of the vote. But here, Roosevelt, very, very popular with the American people, a mandate to continue his policies of the previous 4 years. So, David's defeated Goliath. The heads of the Hydra are being cut off. Well, not really. As I say, Roosevelt's movements to break up the trusts were more of a threat than anything else. The trusts were still very, very powerful, and interestingly enough, Rockefeller contributed to Teddy Roosevelt's 1904 re-election campaign with good reason. Teddy Roosevelt did not pose any threat, really, to the tremendous wealth of monopolists like Rockefeller. Roosevelt was only concerned of, you know, kind of getting them to behave. Don't go too far, and we'll leave you alone. Even the conservation measures passed by Roosevelt tended, in many ways, to work to the advantage of rapid big businesses who could sometimes cope more easily with government regulation than a smaller group might be. But also, it's not altogether clear that Roosevelt was always on the right side. Was he really the David against Goliath, or was he the Goliath against some of the Davids of the world? An example of perhaps a potential problem is what happened in the case of the Panama Canal. For a long, long time, people had dreamed, I should have a map up here, but for a long, long time, people had dreamed of cutting a canal across Central America in one place or another. To have a canal there would allow ships to go from the Atlantic to the Pacific without going around the tip of South America. It would save thousands of miles, a lot of time. All you needed was a canal. There were a number of places where that canal could have been built. Possibility of building it through Nicaragua, possibility of building it through Panama. There had actually been attempts to start a canal, but nobody had ever consistently had the resources to do that. Well, where do you build this canal? Roosevelt wanted to see that canal built. Be great for American shipping and all sorts of different things. He wanted to see the canal built, and he proposed building the canal through Panama. Panama controlled by the Colombian government. Well, the Colombian government, of course, wanted that canal built, but what did Roosevelt offer? Roosevelt offered $10 million and $250,000 a year, and this would allow the United States to control a strip 6 miles wide through Panama. Kind of a sizable amount of territory, and notice that this is an incredibly valuable resource. Access to, from the Atlantic to the Pacific, certainly it was worth more than that. And the Bogota Senate, the Colombian Senate said, no way, this is, now you ask, why didn't they build the canal themselves? Simply they didn't have the resources. This digging of this canal was going to be a major, major expense, a major engineering fee and all of that. Colombia could not build the canal themselves, but they certainly wanted more in compensation than Roosevelt was prepared to offer. Well, Teddy Roosevelt has this sense of fair play, and his sense of fair play is anything that I propose is fair, and if they reject it, if they want more, that's unfair. So this gives Teddy Roosevelt the excuse that he needs to seize his big stick if the opportunity presents itself. And the opportunity did present itself. In 1903, there was a revolution in Panama. Panamanians trying to get their independence from Colombia. So Roosevelt comes in, brings in American ships, and stops Colombia from putting down the rebellion, stops from Colombia from maintaining its control of Panama. And now what can Roosevelt do? Now Roosevelt can negotiate with the new Panamanian government. A new form government is going to be weak, and it's going to have to accept whatever terms Roosevelt offers. And so Roosevelt now has his ability to build that canal. Well, the canal's built, and it's a good thing. Tremendous sacrifice of life as the people are building it, tremendous expense and all of that, but long term, that Panama Canal is a good kind of thing. Question then with the Panama Canal, what does it show? Does it show Roosevelt as a progressive president? Well, I guess. I mean, he's getting this tremendous thing, tremendous engineering achievement accomplished. You guys have probably seen that palindrome. Reads the same, a man, a plan, a canal, Panama. And it reads the same backwards, a man, a plan. Yes, you've all seen that. Some of you have seen it. Some of you have not seen it. Anyway, one of the most famous palindromes around a man, a plan, a canal, Panama. Yeah, tremendous engineering feat. Good for the world, good for the United States, maybe even good for the people of Panama. But the way Teddy Roosevelt got that, is this really a victory for progressives? And this is really what America wants to be in the world. Roosevelt changes American foreign policy. For a long, long time, America had followed the foreign policy, what was called the Monroe Doctrine. It goes back to James Monroe. James Monroe said that what the United States would do is it would protect the Western Hemisphere against European intervention. European powers came into the Western Hemisphere, the United States would intervene to stop them. Well, Roosevelt adds to that the Roosevelt corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. What Roosevelt said is that if internal conditions in a South American country or Latin American country, if it makes it look like the European countries are going to intervene, then America will intervene preventatively. For instance, Cuba. Well, we had this right anyway by the Platt Amendment, but there is instability in Cuba. What happens? America fears, oh, it's too unstable. European countries are going to come in. Maybe Germany's going to take over. And so America brings its troops in to settle the conditions in Cuba so that no European country can intervene. And this means a tremendous change in the perception of America. We had forfeited a good deal of the goodwill that presidents like Cleveland had built up. Prior to this time, most Latin American countries viewed America as a good big brother, somebody that would protect them against European intervention. Now, America seemed ready to intervene at the drop of a hat, just on the chance that a European country was going to intervene. And this was not exactly the same kind of thing. Well, there's Roosevelt. A victory for the progressives, at best, let's say, sort of. Let's take a break here. Take 7 minutes, and I'll reach back here at 10 after, and we'll go on to Taft and Wilson.